Okay, I'm going to say a series of things that I've never said before. I'm sitting here in our studios. It's 7:18 on Thursday night, December 20th. We're about to do a show with 9 Nose panelists. And frankly, I think it's going to be kind of a mess. Our goal is to have a conversation about the year and culture. And as they emailed around, as they do, 9 people trying to identify what they thought was important in culture, it turns out they've all been walking on essentially 9 different trails through the woods of culture. And it's nighttime. We don't usually do the show at night, and there's too many of them, and we're trying to remember why it was we wanted to do this. All of which should make you really interested in what comes next, so stay with us. All right. Why did I think this was a good idea? Maybe it is a good idea. We have 9 Nose panelists here. It's 8 o'clock at night. We're doing our show live at 8 p.m. It'll be rebroadcast also at 1 and survive on the internet and podcast world forever, unless something goes drastically wrong, which it might. So there are 9 of us, 9 of them here, plus a special surprise guest. He's never done the Nose before. General James Mattis is with us tonight. He did not think he was going to be available, but sir, General, just make yourself at home, and you'll pick up the flow of this pretty quickly. It's like war, but, you know, fewer people get hurt. All right. I'm going to tell you everybody who you're going to hear, and I'm going to do it quickly because we could blow the whole show just saying everybody's names. Rebecca Castellani, Director of Venue Operations for Tour Marketing for We Save Music. Jim Chapdelaine, Emmy Award-winning musician, producer, composer, recording engineer, patient advocate for people with rare cancers. Rand Richards Cooper, contributing editor at Common Wheel, writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine. Tanisha Dugan is producing associate at the Theater Works. James Hanley, co-founder of Cine Studio at Trinity College. Rich Holland is principal and design director at CoLab and a commissioner on cultural affairs for the city of Hartford. Jacques Lamar, a playwright and senior project manager at Buzz Engine. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. Kate Russian is a poet who was recently commissioned to write and deliver a poem commemorating the 125th anniversary of the Hartford Public Library. She's also going to be performing her poetry with the Nat Reeves Quartet at Westminster School in Simsbury on January 11th. Okay, that's everybody. They're all in the studio, but they can't all talk at once, obviously. So we'll be rotating them in and out. Irene, you said this is like being with your family?
Yes, because we all know each other, and there's like people in the background singing, and, you know, everybody's sort of jittering around, and like alliances are rising and departing, and yeah.
So, yeah, it is these people have been making radio shows together for, we don't even know how many years The Nose has been on the air, but Irene and Rand and Jacques, I think, were on the first one ever. So what I want to do is, for the beginning, we're going to be talking about the year in culture, but I thought it might be interesting to get the first four of you, just we're going to get into specifics, movies, music, television, food, all kinds of stuff. But it's sort of, there's also kind of a gestalt to any year. There's sort of a vibe to any year. You know, did it feel like American culture was cohesive and producing lots of things that made you happy? Jacques, for example, I feel as though you always seem pretty happy, and you seemed happy with culture in 2018. Maybe I have that wrong, but if I'm not, what made you so happy?
You know, I don't know that I was ecstatic. Like, I feel like last year I saw almost all of, if not all of, the films that were nominated for an Oscar, for example. I don't necessarily feel like I've had sort of that level of excitement about any particular field of endeavor this year, except for I obsessively read any of the books that were trashing Donald Trump. But, you know, I don't necessarily feel of it like it was a bad year, but maybe it just wasn't the most exciting year.
All right. I was counting on you to be the cheerleader. All right.
No,
can somebody else do better? Rich, can you
Sorry.
Do better?
I'm not going to do any better. Yeah. This was a fallow year.
Yeah.
It was the year where culture took a nap in the hopes of getting a heck of a lot better next year. And the evidence of that is already starting to kick in over the past couple of months. Good stuff is happening, things that people should see and should be listening to.
What springs to mind?
Spider-Verse,
yeah.
For example. That was tremendous. We just went to see it the other day. It was unexpected. It was the animation was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The storyline was as dopey as a superhero thing should be, and yet cut through a little deeper. It was, you know, basically the blue wave that we were hoping for in an animation form.
So it's picking up speed all of a sudden. All right, so it's been kind of meh a little bit. So, and I know, Irene, you can get the mic over to Rich, it's to Jim, so it'll be ready. But Irene, I think you and I felt similarly lost this year. Like, I feel like I've been wandering a path in the woods of culture, bumping into Bob Woodward once in a while. But other than that, I don't remember much about it.
Right. This because I said, oh, what have I liked in 2018? 2018, let's see, Phantom Thread? No, that was 2017. Mindhunter? No, that was 2017 too. And my mind was blank. And I know I haven't not taken in any culture, but I just sort of feel like, I don't know. I've been paying attention to is more maybe personal stuff, but also, you know, the national news and where is culture. And So that's kind of where I am. And everything just seems so bleak. But there's an idea. I mean, I guess if I step back and think about that, there's the idea that, well, that's where art can flourish. Mm-hmm. In my personal life, I haven't really been encountering that flourishing.
All right. Well, maybe as we go along here and get into the specifics, people will find ways in which that did happen. Or, Jim, this is your one chance. You could save 2018 from oblivion if you could say something nice about it.
All right. I would offer the theory that I didn't have enough – let me use a cheesy corporate word, bandwidth. I didn't have enough room for culture the way I normally would this year because there was an important election that found me knocking on people's doors inappropriately. I saw most of the movies I saw, I'd say about 80%, were movies that – were assigned because of the show. And I was always grateful for it. I was like, yes, now I have to go to the movies. And I can't watch this TV show or read any of the books that Jacques was talking about. So I wonder if a lot of us just got crowded out from some of this stuff that we would normally be kicking back at. Like, for example, reading fiction. I don't even know what fiction is right now.
Right. I think it's things that are not true, but that's also happening.
Who knows what that is?
Yes, exactly. Right. Objective truth is taking a hit. All right. So that's the overview. We're going to use a Betsy Kaplan endorsement to give Jim and Rich a chance to exit and Rebecca and James a chance to take over their mic, which they will now have to share. We have a little broken mic problem here, which General Mattis is on the floor working on right now. He's trying to rewire the whole thing back together again. So while that's happening, we're going to transition to movies. Senior producer Betsy Kaplan has a movie, which I also would have endorsed as a year-end endorsement if anybody had asked me.
One movie from 2018 that still sticks with me is Leave No Trace. It's a story about Will and Tom, a father and daughter who live off the grid in the woods outside of Portland, Oregon. We don't really know why, but we learn that the depth of these characters is inversely proportional to the few words they use to show it. Director Deborah Granick drops little bits of clues about the unknown backstory of Will and Tom's lives. She doesn't need to do more. Their faces tell the rest. It's a gentle movie. No adrenaline-inducing action or tear-jerking tragedy or stereotyped characters. When you expect indifference, you find a human touch. Who would have thought? Leave No Trace was slow and scenic and quiet, yet so much was said about respect and love and pain and war and survival. Granick doesn't tell you what to think. Maybe that's why it lingers with me. There's so much to think about. I liked it better than Keith, although he was a sucker for the beauty of the Portland forest.
She should say, made it clear, she liked it better than her husband Keith liked it. She didn't like it better than she likes her husband Keith. I feel somewhat secure in saying that.
I'm glad you explained that.
Not 100% clear. So, James, grab the mic, rotate it over towards you a little bit. James Hanley, since you're watching the movie business pretty carefully, I have a pretty good sense of how 2018 was going. And do you think this is going to turn out to have been a good year in movies?
Well, actually, yes. I would say I would agree about Leave No Trace.
Me too.
I thought that was a really special film.
Yeah.
There were two films that stood out to me. The other one was, I think I mentioned on the email chain, a German film called The Captain, which almost nobody saw. But one of the things that has really started to happen now is that the digital media, the availability of digital media for people who want to make everything really from music, films, art, whatever, is so ubiquitous and so inexpensive that there's a huge flow of material, and that affects the movie industry tremendously. You really have, on the one hand, you have maybe a dozen tentpoles throughout the year, which are big blockbusters that that absorb the vast majority of screens. But there's a huge number of small films, many of which are really interesting and really absorbing, and they really make you think. But so few of them actually get seen by a large number of people. And that sort of bothers me. And I don't know if there's an answer to that, because I always felt, you know, when digital cinema came in, much as I might have my criticisms of it aesthetically, one of the extraordinary things about it is to make filmmaking accessible to people, especially young people. I mean, we've had films from 10-year-olds on cell phones showing at Cine Studio. And I think that that's
really
huge.
10-year-olds?
Oh, yes, with the Real Heart, Real Youth Hartford Film Festival. And so these kids got to see sort of professional level reproduction of the films they made on a big screen in the dark with their families and friends. And this was a huge revolution to me, because when we first started Cine Studio, I mean, it would have cost $100,000 to make a film. And so it was a very narrow market. And now it's very broad. And it's brought with it a huge embarrassment of riches. I mean, there's so much stuff. And I feel there's so many things that I don't catch up with. It's sort of a regret. But I'm also glad that this medium is available, and that these films do get seen, at least by some people.
Right. I've noticed with some of the critics' year-end list, there are movies that I've never heard of. And I really do try to kind of keep up with that. But because a lot of them are small, or a lot of them are coming from other countries and not playing here. So you might have to hunt around a little bit more and to find these things. Okay. So one that you don't have to hunt around for, which three of our panelists at minimum have seen, is The Favorite. It's out in theaters right now. It's a little bit complicated because it's the OU Favorite. You can spell Favorite two different ways, and there are two different movies this year called The Favorite, just to make everything super confusing. So we should say this is the story of Queen Anne. Well, I'll let somebody who actually saw the damn movie explain what it's the story of. You want to get it going, Irene?
Well, it's very different from the commercial that you might see on TV. First of all, it's a very like the sort of historical background. I'll leave to somebody else. Jacques, do you want to start there?
Well, after I saw the movie, which I saw last night, I loved it. I loved it. I went to see how historically accurate the film is, and it's actually surprisingly accurate, except for the romance between the women. There are letters that indicate certain things, but there is no evidence that these women actually had sexual relationships.
Oh, so we need to explain who these women are. I'm going to turn this over to the scholar over here. Yeah. I do want to say that this particular plot has really interested people, generally speaking. In fall of 2017, I was in the West End of London, where the Royal Shakespeare Company was also doing a play called Queen Anne. It's about the exact same plot that Rebecca is about to describe, but I don't think the movie is based on that play. I think these are two independent explorations of this rather odd relationship. Do you feel up to doing a synopsis? I mean, no spoilers, but
I mean, that's a tough bill.
Just first of all, maybe mention who the actresses are and what's going on.
Sure. So Olivia Colman is playing Queen Anne, and I just adore Olivia Colman. I think she's a rising star. She's taking over for Claire Foy for the next season of The Crown. Mm-hmm. Nice. So she's just a stellar actress.
And did you see The Night Manager?
Yes.
She's in that.
Yes.
British Broadchurch,
which is just fabulous. So she, to me, was the breakout star of that. But then the supporting actresses are Rachel Weisz and Emma Stone, and they are two courtiers that are rivals for the Queen's attention and favor. And madness ensues. It's film. I was mostly struck by how beautifully and interestingly it was filmed. There's a lot of fishbowl lenses and long tracking shots that almost makes you feel sometimes like you're watching a reality television show in a way. And, especially in light in our current political moment as well, there was a lot of stuff that I think modern viewers will understand in a new light, given where we are with Trump. So I very much enjoyed it. I thought that the acting was absolutely stellar. I think that it's one of those movies that's very difficult to describe. Even if we were to give you a whole historical synopsis, the movie itself is a substance that's different from the history surrounding it. And it's more, I think, about the portrayals these women are bringing to the stage that struck me the most. And obviously, it's just filmed beautifully. And the sound engineering is another thing that I was really struck by. And that's something I've recently started being more attuned to in movies, is the choice and direction with sound. And I thought it was just great.
Yes, as well you should, yes.
And it's emotionally surprising I felt like it was exploring emotions in a very, very interesting way. And we really didn't think the same thing about the emotions of the characters by the end as we did in the beginning. Yeah. And there was a certain kind of, yeah, I mean, Rachel Weisz is so great. I just love her. I thought she was amazing. And Emma Stone plays a sort of not her usual character, yes. But it was interesting. You know, but I had some trouble with her, just the way she delivered some of her lines. Jacques, did you like her?
Well, there's very kind of anachronistic things that happen within the film, particularly in the certain dance scene where you're like, what is going
that
on?
That was so good.
But, you know, I love that the movie keeps throwing you little odd curveballs. And it's, mm-hmm. I kind of left thinking it's all about Eve. What would happen if All About Eve and Dangerous Liaisons had a love child that was born on crack, and it was, it was just a weird, exciting film, and I really enjoyed it.
All right, so can we do a quick transition to another movie that created a stir of a kind this year, and that was Crazy Rich Asians. Now I'm trying to remember. You've seen Crazy Rich Asians.
Yes.
You've seen Crazy Rich
yes.
Asians. I've seen it. Have you seen it yet?
You've seen it.
Okay, James, you get it started then. Get us started with. Yes, I know Tanisha is refusing to see it. Right.
Well, I have to say, at first when I read about it and while we were talking about it, some red flags flashed for me that it has a kind of, the synopsis we heard about it and also the trailer that came out, which is, as usual, was made by people totally unrelated to the movie. It had a kind of self-consciousness about it. But it's very interesting that when we showed it at Sony Studio, I really enjoyed it, but as much as anything for the audience. The audience that came on, for the first time, we had a very large number of Asian Americans and Asians who came to see the film and really enjoyed it immensely. And some of the people in the movie had a kind of almost self-conscious sort of way of delivering the lines that the film transcended what I had been suspicious of before. And so I actually enjoyed it very much. And I think the audiences, I went to see it a second time actually with another audience, and the audience just went crazy over it. They just loved it.
You know, Jacques, to me, it certainly works mm-hmm. as a rom-com anyway. I mean, it's just if you stripped away all the cultural baggage and just did it as a rom-com, I was getting a little verklempt at the end.
Yeah, I was watching the film and enjoying it thoroughly from a lot of different standpoints. But, I was trying to think of the last time I had seen a good romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And I could not, I was going back to Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan era, Nora Ephron.
I think this was the year that rom-coms came back into the mainstream in a good way. We've had so many poor years of rom-coms, and I am not a big rom-com fan.
So what was the other rom-com that was any good this year?
To All the Boys I've Loved Before on Netflix, which was really good, and I maybe cried a couple times in that movie. But I was all prepared to dislike Crazy Rich Asians for the same reasons. Jacques, the trailer didn't really do it for me. I was kind of on the fence, and I watched it at home. It was not something I went out to the theaters to see.
And you have to be prepared with this movie to identify with people who essentially would look down on one percenters as really not having quite enough money. And we'll hear a little clip from Crazy Rich Asians. You're going to hear the two romantic leads. Henry Golding is Nick Young. Constance Wu is the ragged little match girl who's the Cinderella figure in this story. I always point out to people she's actually a professor of economics at NYU in the movie, but that amounts to being a ragged little match girl.
Singapore for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family, my ama, and meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Take Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her,
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
Aww.
And I, Jacques, I guess also, if you do get off on opulence, this is a great movie, too.
Yeah, I loved the excess of it. I mean, that just that clip that you played, it immediately launches into a fantastic scene of them, this network of is it Chinese women? Texting. the like they're supposed to be on this private date, and all of a sudden it's literally all over the globe.
Like Gossip Girl.
Yeah, it was, and it was so brilliantly visualized on screen, and I, you know, and A, you know, Henry Golding needs to be the next James Bond. I'm sorry. I'm going out there. I was watching that. I was watching it going, he should be the next James Bond. But, B, you know, I think, and I think Aquafina is unbelievably
funny. Breakout star of 2018.
Yeah. Totally agree with that.
Yeah. Between that and Ocean's 8 or whatever.
But she was the best part of that whole
movie. Yeah, she was the best part of that movie, too. All right, so we're going to do another line change here. We're going to switch over to TV. But before we do that, so James and I have to do an endorsement together, and that is for Amazing Aki.
Yes.
Grab the mic and turn it all around.
Yeah, there's a new...
We should say Rand is going to lead us through a whole food segment at the end of the show, but right now we're going to do a quick food thing. Yeah.
Well, at the Coventry Market, which is in the Coventry High School during the winter, there is a new baker who bakes the most amazing ackee patties. If you don't know what ackee is, it's kind of a fruit that produces this delectable... sort of yellow flesh that looks sort of like scrambled eggs, yes. But with Jamaican spices and put in a beautiful pastry patty, it's just heavenly. And they are the greatest find at the market.
They really
highly recommend it.
It's the Jamaican food patty you've been waiting for because it's light. It has a kind of a light, fluffy texture to it. They sell them at Geisler's up there in Bloomfield and Windsor. If we all, after this show at 9 o'clock, stampeded over to Real Artways, I think they're over there selling them tonight at Creative Cocktail Hour. And James and I get them at the Coventry Farmers Market on Sundays. And they are amazingly good.
Really
it's not
great.
Just ackee, too. They have all kinds of different
flavors. Yeah, that's right. They have lentil ackees.
Wow. It is good. All right. So time to do a line change. What's going to happen is that all that's going to happen is, am I in the right spot here? What's going to happen is, first of all, we're going to hear an endorsement from WNPR's politics producer, Scott Breedy. While that's happening, James and Irene will leave. Jim and Tanisha will join. Here we go.
One thing I've learned with Ryan Murphy shows is that they're either brilliant or they seem phoned in. So you get stuff like the last three seasons of Glee or this year's terrifyingly awful American Horror Story Apocalypse. But it's a holiday, so I'm staying positive and giving props to another 2018 Ryan Murphy show, Pose. It's groundbreaking because it has the largest cast of trans actors in television history. It depicts New York City ball culture in the 1980s, where you have these giant dance-offs and over-the-top outfits and lots of snarky put-downs. But it also has a sappy Waltons-esque quality to it, where all is forgiven at the end of each episode between Blanca, who is the main character, in the LGBTQ homeless youth that she has taken in from off the streets. Blanca even manages to mend fences with her arch rival, Elektra, after a season full of verbal catfighting between the two. And I really hope that next season they're feuding again because it's so fun to watch.
All right, so that's Scott Breedy endorsing Pose, which a lot of critics also have endorsed or picked as among their top 10. We're going to talk a little bit about television right now. As I say, we have some new panelists. Jim has come back. Tanisha is with us for the first time. We're going to start, I think, with Queer Eye. And just to get this going, Jonathan, let's do A5. Let's just hear a little bit of Queer Eye on Netflix.
Yes! When you put a gaggle of gay guys in a trailer in the middle of Appalachian Trail Mountains, honey, we're gonna give you a fashion show.
Da, 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 da. Yes! Yes!
Get it, get it, get it, get it. Walk it,
Every day, every day.
Do it right.
Every day, every day, every day.
Do it right.
All right, that's a song they made out of little bits of their own dialogue. So, Tanisha, do you want to start us going here? This is obviously, it's been on, I guess, for a couple of seasons now on Netflix.
Two, right?
And it's a total reboot from the original Queer Eye, which I was a big fan of.
It is, and I'm like old enough to know the original and this one, and I loved it. And I remember
that's not that old. I just want to say,
thank you, Boo. I'm not that old. I remember watching the newest one while I was in Louisville on business, and I was sitting in the hotel room, and I'm watching this thing, and I'm like bawling because I remembered how beautiful this entire like. Who do you think you are and who do you want to be? And here is this like troop of gay guys that are going to come in and help you be your most authentic self. And I don't know what that means to like do that with a group of gay guys if you're a straight guy. But I think it really sort of, to me, connected this individualism that I think has been, you know, in the conversation that we've been having about culture. Like, we don't feel that we are a part of it because we all feel very like, I am a black woman and I am a queer woman and I am in this world and I'm in this box and this is the thing that I listen to and this is the thing that I read and this is the thing, the movie that I watch. And what was so amazing about Queer Eye is that it kind of broke that open for us because we were able to see a bunch of dudes of one sexuality, but many experiences changing the lives of people. And it was dope and exciting and loving.
All right. So, yeah, we have to go through this pretty quickly because I'm already frying the clock here a little bit.
I'll shut up. Okay,
so, No. It's not one person's problem. So, Jacques, I was a huge fan of the original series. I think I watched all the episodes, including the one where they did a makeover for the Boston Red Sox, which I thought was just unbelievably hilarious. But and I've just never made the transition to this one. I mean, sell it to me.
It's better.
Yeah.
It's better. It's more emotional.
Things just keep getting better.
Exactly. I'm trying to figure out what the secret sauce is this time that makes it better. But I mean, Hart.
Jonathan Van Ness.
But all of them, you know, the Karamo, because, you know, the guy who was the quote-unquote culture guy, Jai Rodriguez in the first?
Oh, yeah.
You're kind of like, I don't get his job. But, like, Karamo, you're like, I can't wait till you talk again.
Yes.
And they're much more diverse selection of not only of the gay men, but of the people that they're with. And it's not this whole thing of like we're treating this, you know, straight men. It's not all straight men that they're doing, you know, quote unquote makeovers for. But they're way beyond makeovers. They're like spiritual makeovers. They're crying, you're crying, the gays are crying.
I feel like it makes over me. Like every episode I watch, I feel like it's completely changing my life and all of these lessons that they're giving me. These are happening to these like ill-dressed white men. I don't have much to relate to with them, but here I am at the end of the episode.
Yeah, you are sitting next to Jim.
I know, minus in this specific moment. But usually this is like not my experience. And I just feel so this empathy for, you know, a demographic I typically don't have a ton of.
I think you've hit on the gist of it, right? Which is that most of the protagonists are that.
Yes.
Right? And so we are dealing with that and we're trying to crack that open. And we've got a cast of characters who are so invested in cracking that open that we all have this cathartic.
And the emotion behind it is so unexpected at times. Like, it's so lighthearted and fun and funny, and they're so quirky, and all of their one-liners are just perfect and land, and it's lighthearted. And then something will catch you off guard that you're just suddenly, like, in the middle of laughing, and you're just weeping. There's an episode in the first season that deals with police brutality. They make over a cop, and it has one of the most moving conversations between a person of color and a police officer that I think it should be mandatory viewing for everyone. It was really unbelievably moving, and I think it is far and away my favorite thing to come out of this year.
Wow. So, Jim, say one thing about this, and then we'll go to a break.
I want to be made over. That's what I can say. But I don't live in Georgia.
Right. All right. So if anybody wants to make Jim Chapdelaine over, email me, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. We'll take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to bring in some other people. We're going to talk about music. At the end of the show, the final segment, Rand will be leading us in a conversation about food.
Oh, yeah. Things keep getting better.
All right, there were some events in 2018, some cultural moments in 2018 that pretty much, you know, everybody partook of. I mean, sort of everybody you knew was going to make it eventually, I think, to Black Panther. Most of us here in the room did. Let's hear a little clip to get us in the mood.
Ulysses Klaue plans to sell the vibranium to an American buyer in South Korea tomorrow night.
Klaue has escaped our pursuits for almost 30 years. Not capturing him is perhaps my father's greatest regret. I wish to bring Klaue back here to stand trial.
Wakanda does not need a warrior right now. We need a king.
My parents were killed when he attacked. Not a day goes by when I do not think about what Klaue took from us. From me.
It's too great an opportunity to pass.
Take me with you. We'll take him down together, side by side.
They need you here, protecting the border.
Then I ask, do you kill him where he stands? Or you bring him back to us?
You have my word. I will bring him back.
All right, so we talked about this on the nose when the movie came out. In fact, two of the panelists who were on that show are sitting around the rim right now. So, Kate, you know, when it came out, it was obviously this huge, huge cultural moment. People had been waiting a long time for it. Ryan Coogler was so clearly the right director to do this. How has it aged in your mind? Are you as excited about Black Panther now as you were when it came out?
You know, I haven't actually thought about it in a while, but when I do think about it, I think about the excitement in the audience, how it affected people all across the spectrum, all ages, all backgrounds. And I think about the strength of the women, the bad costumes, and I think about I'm really glad there was Angela Bassett and Forrest Whitaker were in Black Panther as the elders, because frankly, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm really fed up with this, what I see as intergenerational hostility that's going on.
They're sort of gray panthers, actually. all right, so Rand, since you weren't on that show, I don't know what you thought of Black Panther.
Well, first of all, you know, when a movie's released in January and we're talking about in December, the memory of it perhaps because we're all sort of culturally overloaded, has attenuated a little bit. You know, this was a huge year for movies. Box office records were set, and I think 8 of the top 10 performers at the box office were based on comics, on cartoons. So the comic book epic action huge budget film is just crushing the box office. And that makes me think of what James was talking about before, all the really small, interesting films that barely get an audience. When I write about films, I try to write almost exclusively about those. So I suppose I'm saying in a somewhat lukewarm way that I like the film a lot, but it seemed almost to me more important in terms of what it represented in the evolution of African-American based films getting major audiences and sort of demolished really the kind of ghettoization of African American films into so-called niche audiences, and it was very exciting to see that happen based on this kind of restoration fantasy of African civilizational greatness. So I kind of, you know, I really appreciated that.
This one, throwing like so many hot words into the like mix, you know? One of the things I think that, Kate, you talk about that I think is really interesting to me is that there's something about culture in 2018 that's moving so fast that you don't even know if this happened this year or not, right? And I think that is, you know, I hate to do this because I hate to give attention to this thing that I think is consuming us. But I think there's something very Trumpian and something very about this time, about like moving so fast past a moment that you don't know when the hell, excuse my language, when it happened, right? And I think Black Panther is consumed by that, that I think despite the words you use to describe it, which make me uncomfortable, quite frankly, I think it is absolutely a comic book film that is a monster and a giant, and we cannot deny that it made the block, you know, the box office numbers that it did, and it sort of superseded blackness, right? Because yes, the black dollar we've learned this year is legit and real and can change a country and can make people own homes. But it superseded that, Black Panther did. And I think that was an awakening for America to finally say, because this is an unabashedly black project, that unabashedly black culture that is not hiding behind a whiteness or an acceptability is us. Like, it's you, Rand. It's you, Jim. It's you, Colin. And we all showed up for it. And that was dope.
You didn't mention General Mattis. Actually, he didn't see it, apparently. He's very...
He
very
lied.
Serious. So, yeah,
totally
Jim,
saw it.
Since you mentioned you grabbed the mic.
I don't know how I can add to this, except to say that in a world in which 90% of our movies are generated by comic books, this is the one you want to see, I think. Even though tonight we're going to talk about, I think, if we get to them, three movies that are all generated by comic books. This would be my favorite of them. in addition to everything we're hearing.
Although Rich made
it's
a pretty,
pretty
good,
amazing.
Pretty good case for the new Spider-Man.
He did.
An animated one, too. All right, so we need to do a shift change here. I think we might have to trade out Jim and bring in Jacques so we can get to Janelle Monae. And while we're doing that, let's hear Carlos Mejia, our digital producer at WNPR. He's got an endorsement of some kind.
2018 was great because my daughter was born, and since I can't endorse my baby, I'll instead endorse a game that I barely have time to play because I'm always with my baby. That game is Red Dead Redemption 2. Red Dead Redemption 2 is the best video game I've played all year. Typically, games are praised for their amazing visual graphics, and this game is filled with them. There are beautiful landscapes and cities that mirror real life and historical locations like Yellowstone Park and New Orleans. But what makes Red Dead 2 so good is the writing. You play as Arthur Morgan, an outlaw gunslinger, as you and your friends in the Vanderlyn gang shoot, steal, and heist their way through 1899. The game has over 100 hours of playable content, and I know I'll be lucky if I could even get half that far. But it also has an incredible soundtrack, really amazing voice acting, and it makes for a video game experience that has made me more emotional than any movie I've seen this year.
However, if you really like the sound of that, you may have trouble buying that particular game in time for Christmas. it's one of those things that's sort of missing. Like Amazon can't get it to you now. So that was Carlos Mejia. Let's talk a little bit about at least one moment in music. I've been a Janelle Monae fan since Tightrope, which I still maintain is the greatest music video ever done by anybody. So I had a little less time to get to Dirty Computer this year. I guess maybe we should begin by just hearing a little bit of Make Me Feel.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for you. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions.
For the sake of time, I have to fade it out right now. So, Kate, you're back into the mix here. Janelle Monae, I feel like it should be as big a superstar, you know, as, I don't know, as any Jackson, as Prince. I mean, she can kind of do it all. I feel like she's less familiar to people. But I don't know, give people a reason to seek this one out.
I think she's on her way. I've loved her ever since I first saw her. I love her retro style. I love her James Brown dancing. I love her boldness. I love her coolness. Janelle Monae is my shero.
All right. How about you, Jacques?
Well, you know, she first came on my radar with Tightrope, and I got Arch Android, which I didn't love start to finish. And Electric Lady, there was a great – I'm trying to remember what the song was, but there was a great single. And I just I wanted her to be a great album artist, and I feel like this album – I was initially very drawn to the Prince-like sound of Make Me Feel, and the first and only time I've seen her live was opening for Prince at Mohegan Sun. And so, I think that she carves this wonderful identity for herself, and also she's become an amazing actor, too. And so I think that she's bringing that sense of performance to her record as well.
Yeah. You're so right. I think she found her essence when Prince died. You know, and I think that's a sad thing because I think in some ways she's Prince's spirit animal. And I think what Dirty Computer did for her was allowed her to really lean into the zeitgeist that she fulfills so well, which is this androgynous, totally urban, working class sound that Prince embodied. And until that space was evacuated, she couldn't really be who she is right now. And I think we're just about to see the best of who she can be.
Can I throw in a quick thing?
Yes.
Just that Prince actually released an album posthumously this year that was amazing, called Piano and a Microphone, 1983. And it's just him with a piano at the peak of his powers. And it's him just kind of jamming for no one other than himself.
So whoever loves me and hasn't bought me a Christmas present, that is at the top of my list.
All right. So let's go out of this segment with a cut from another album. It can be The Carters or Michelle. Let's have a vote.
Michelle.
Oh, yeah, Michelle.
Michelle from,
sure.
From Ventriloquism.
Yes.
I always screw up the last name. Say the last name.
Ndegio Cello.
Okay, I wouldn't have done that so well. All right, here we go. From the album Ventriloquism. All right, we're back. If you're listening at night, tell your friends that this show will also be. We're live here at 8 p.m., but you tell your friends that we'll be on at 1 p.m. If you're listening at 1 p.m., don't even bother with what I'm saying right now. We're going to talk about food here at the end, but as we make that little transition, we have asked, as you can tell, a lot of our producers and staff people around here to make some endorsements. I also want to quickly say that this is usually where Wolfie does the credits. She's not here. It's 8 o'clock at night. And it's just me and Jonathan McPants. That's basically – and I think the security guy has actually been pretty helpful just in terms of helping people get in and out of the building. So,
like an interruption, but shout out to you guys giving your colleagues a voice in this and allowing them to have these endorsements. It's been beautiful and wonderful and exciting.
We always enjoy hearing from them. Let's hear what our digital producer, Tucker Ives, liked.
A couple of years ago, Formula One racing went from the conventional engine to a hybrid engine, kind of the Prius of auto racing. And then a couple of years ago, they started Formula E, which is vehicles that are entirely electric. So this is where a lot of the manufacturers are putting a lot of research and development into these cars. And eventually, the technology that they're using in this racing is going to trickle down into everyday automobiles. So last weekend, they just kicked off their first race of the season. They were in Saudi Arabia. Of course, a little ironic. The cars are extremely quiet. It's not the big thundering roars that you may expect from, say, a stock car like NASCAR or the traditional Formula One vehicles. The cars are not as fast as the Formula One counterparts, but they are on these very tight circuits, mostly street circuits. So the racing is really fun and they're really close together and there are crashes. It's just not quite as loud.
All right. So I promised food. We're going to do food. But actually, before we do food, though, Rand, very quickly, because our time is a little bit limited here, but you're a man of the world. You go out on the town not only to eat, but apparently to drink and throw axes. Tell us about this.
Well, the axe throwing craze trickled down from the wilds of Canada and has been replicating itself in cool places around the country. And there are now a couple of axe throwing places, one in Hartford. The one I went to is called Montana Knights in Newington. It's all it's an old warehouse. It's decorated in kind of lodge-like, Western lodge-like appointments. And you can actually, it sounds like a terrible combination. You can drink beer and throw axes. Mm. They're just little hatchets. They only weigh 2 pounds, and you are isolated in a cage. And when you go there, you're put on a team, and everyone takes like a fake moniker. And it's actually a lot of fun.
I just like to be there when the guy gets the loan for that. You know, like really, this is going to be popular for years to come. I don't have any problem. I've got a 10-year business plan for axe throwing at my bar. All right, so Rand, you still have the floor here. You do review restaurants.
So I do. And I go to restaurants a lot, and I'm very impressed by the people who are running restaurants in Connecticut. And you know, we can all list our favorite restaurants and places that you get great food. But above and beyond the great food, I worked in restaurants when I was in my 20s, and I was a waiter, and yeah, we had fun, but it was a really pretty depraved kind of fun. It was a really a big blowout scene, and I meet young people in their 30s, and they're having a sort of fun that involves real creativity and in many cases a sense of mission, and it's very holistic in that people are getting involved in all phases of food growing and preparing, and this has really just become sort of standard stuff for restaurants. So I just want to mention a couple. There's a great restaurant newish in New Haven called Olives and Oil, and it's a sort of Italian gastropub. They've got this Vespa over the door. It's like, you know, Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn are going to ride in on the Vespa. The chef's name is John Brennan. He has a blog called Cheap Date Blog, and it's a combination of storytelling, jokes, but also recipes and sort of meticulous photographs. It's almost like a deconstructed video, and I prefer it to a video. But he doesn't have to do it. He puts a lot of time into it, and it's clearly like part of his mission. Another mission place, very important, a place called Bistro on Main that opened this year in Manchester. And the guy makes – the chef's name is Ben Dubois. He's also a pastor. And they've hooked in with the Manchester Area Conference of Churches. And they run their restaurant. First of all tips go as charitable donations to their various causes. And their restaurant is also a training program. Almost everyone who works there is someone who has come to them through the from the food pantry or through the church's charitable outreach. And they train people for culinary jobs there. And as I said, the bouillabaisse is great, too. And the third restaurant I would point to is a series of restaurants actually owned by Dan Meisner and James Wayman down in the Mystic Stonington area, Engine Room, Oyster Company, and Grass and Bone. And they've bought a 100-acre farm down there called Stone Acres. And they have done things like they hooked up with a chef named Dan Giusti, who has worked now to completely redo the food preparation in the New London Public Schools. And they're running educational outreach programs from their farm. They're teaching kids about farming from all these communities. And it's awesome. And I think it's just all of these developments in the whole restaurant culture.
You've nailed it, man.
They're just so beautiful,
it's
really.
It's true. I mean, it hurts me as a person who works in high culture to say, but it is the food culture that has really changed the game. I mean, they are bringing all of the people together. And I want to talk about Tim Cabral, who runs Ordinary and who's also the beverage director at Prone and Pina, and Tyler Anderson, who's also Prone and Pina and Cook and the Bear, and Heather Schold, who works at the Goodwin Hotel, who
right.
has been
Absolutely.
Doing
Cook and the Bear,
yeoman's
Jamie.
Work of trying to use their art form to bring community together. Mm-hmm. I mean, food is the thing that we all can walk into without controversy, right? All the other art forms, we have a point of view about. The artist is trying to push an opinion or an agenda, and food is easy, and you've nailed it. It's a beautiful 2018, 2019, hopefully 2020 way for us to come together and commune. It's real.
All right, so to whatever extent food is controversial, and it can be controversial, donuts maybe theoretically are not. And Rand was emailing us about high-end donuts. First of all, Irene, have you been to Donut Crazy yet?
No. I walked by it, so but good. I haven't. But I'm inspired
but
after
you have,
reading.
But you have been to it.
Of course.
And this is a high-end donut, right?
I've got a student at the
this
University of
West
Hartford
Center
who
has a place
works
called Donut Crazy.
At Donut Crazy. It's crazy donuts. It's maple bacon donuts. It's Cookie Monster donuts that are blue and chocolate chip. It's all the things you could ever want, and then also some very classic glazed yeasty.
How much these donuts cost? Rich wants to know.
I have no idea. Yeah. I just bought them because.
Well, like,
I love the kids.
So, Rand, you're a fan of the Grand Central Station.
Well, I just walked by it the other day, and it's called Donut Plant, and it has all these beautiful donuts. One of them was a miniature donut, blue, sort of cerulean blue, with these little glittering gold stars on it. And I realized it was a donut replica of the ceiling mural in the main concourse of Grand Central Station. Now, I walked away with three donuts for $13.
Right. Highbrow brilliant, lowbrow brilliant.
So,
so Rich would like to make one proletarian statement here on this show.
I'd like to speak for the people for a second here. $13 for three donuts
is
sort of it's outrageous, right? Yeah. So, and I do want to agree that food is the capacity for bringing people together, right? You know, but when we start saying that it only brings some of the people together and the other people have to stand outside like Bob Hatchett and his son watching you eat your turkey, that's a bit much, right? $13 for three donuts is outrageous.
So you're going to quickly endorse
I'm going to endorse French crullers from Dunkin' Donuts. It's like about $1, and you can't beat it. And I don't care whether your donut looks like it's the ceiling of the Grand Central or not. You're not going to beat
it. So do we have time? All right. So all of this food that you eat, it's got to go somewhere, right? When you're all done, Kyone Wolf wants to tell you about that.
2018 has been one of the best years of my life. I got engaged. We bought a house. I got my first haircut in 17 years. And I would like to endorse doing all those things. But what I'd really like to endorse are bidets. A bidet is this contraption you put on your toilet and it washes your butt. And you may be cringing right now at the idea of it, which doesn't make any sense because you wash your butt. You just probably wash it in the shower. And much like an optician said to me when selling me glasses, he said, do you want scratches on your lenses or do you want to pay a little bit of extra money to get a protective sealant so you don't get scratches? And so I ask you, do you want a clean butt? If so, you should get a bidet. The only problem with bidets is when you go somewhere where there's no bidet and then you realize how much you miss it.
All right. When we say the show is going to end, we mean it's going to end. All right. Thanks to Rebecca Castellani, Jim Chapdelaine, Rand Richards-Cooper, Tanisha Dugan, James Hanley, Rich Holland, Jacques Lamar, Irene Papoulis, Kate Rushen, General James Mattis. He didn't say much, but we felt a lot safer having him here. Thanks to Jonathan McNichol for pulling this whole amazing circus together. And we'll be back, sort of after Christmas, kind of, although we might have something for you before Christmas. Woodbury.
hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.